This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, filling in for Neal Conan. In what was to be his final novel, The Last Tycoon, F. Scott Fitzgerald explored the inner world of Hollywood. He wrote, "You can take Hollywood for granted, like I did, or you can dismiss it with the contempt we reserve for what we don't understand. It can be understood, too, but only dimly and in flashes. Not half a dozen men have ever been able to keep the whole equation of pictures in their heads." Now, more than 60 years later, a new book inspired by this quote attempts to decipher Hollywood. In The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood, movie critic David Thompson weaves together the characters, stories, and motivations that make up American film. Later in the program, is sleeping in public a constitutional right? Several homeless people in San Diego say yes, and they're filing a class action lawsuit to prove it. But first, is Hollywood living up to its past, or is it out of touch with mainstream American desires? If you have a question about Hollywood, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. David Thompson joins us now from member station KALW in San Francisco. Good to have you with us.
I'm so pleased to be here.
Now, why did you feel the need to write another book about Hollywood?
Well, when you say another book about Hollywood, it sort of suggests that the bookshelf is already crammed with books that tell the whole story. I have a very large film library because of it's my business. And I've got several books on different movie stars, several books on certain film directors, books on different studios, different genres, all that kind of thing. But it seemed to me that we had reached the stage of specialization where no one for a couple of decades had taken on the task of telling the history of American film as a whole. And I felt it might be time to do that. We were at approximately the 100th anniversary of moving pictures in the late 90s. And so I have tried to do it, and I've tried to reflect not just on the history, but how much the movies may have shaped America, for good or ill.
What do you mean by the whole equation? And that last part of your explanation fits into this idea of the whole equation, the relationship between movies and America.
Well, Fitzgerald was a man who never really succeeded in Hollywood. He'd been a very successful novelist, but he didn't get the knack of writing for movies. There's a very funny scene in The Last Tycoon where a novelist flounders around because he simply doesn't understand how movie stories work. But Fitzgerald was very moved by the movies, I think, and he wanted to be a success, and he had seen them operating. He'd been there quite a lot. And I think he was very impressed with the way in which people like Irving Thalberg did make them work. And principally, and I think this is what the whole equation is, it's the ability to make money, to make best-selling films, and yet at the same time to make films that truly move the country, maybe do good for the country, for the audience, and maybe change us, maybe carry us along. And I think that from the beginning, Hollywood and American film has had that notion, let's make a fortune and let's make great art at the same time. It's a very American attitude. In a lot of other countries, if you are setting up to be an artist, you rule out the possibility that you might also make a good living. Art is sort of by definition for a minority, and it's done for its own sake. In America, I think, there is, and it's in keeping with the whole special different quality of America, there is that feeling, that hope, that we might have our cake and eat it if we are artists, which is to say, we make art and we make a fortune at the same time, and we live in the mansion on Mulholland Drive, and we have several wives and limousines, and we are famous, and we have that American lifestyle, which allegedly so many Americans would like to get in on.
You start your book with the story of Robert Towne and the movies he couldn't make. He's best known for the film Chinatown. So before I ask you about that story, I want to hear a clip from that film, from Chinatown. In this clip, Faye Dunaway is grilling a young Jack Nicholson about their relationship. And here's the clip.
You see, I'm Mrs. Evelyn Mulray. You know Mr. Mulray's wife?
Not that Mulray.
Yes, Mr. Giddy's that Mulray. And since you agree with me that we've never met before, you must also agree with me that I've never hired you to do anything, certainly not spy on my husband. I see you like publicity, Mr. Giddy's. Well, you're going to get it.
Now, wait a minute, Mrs. Mulray. I think there's been some misunderstanding here. There's no point in getting tough with me.
Don't get tough with anyone, Mr. Giddy's. My lawyer does.
That was Faye Dunaway and Jack Nicholson in Chinatown. And in the book, you tell the story, you explain that Chinatown was supposed to be the beginning of a trilogy, and the trilogy was never made. And the story of why it was never made reveals a lot about Hollywood.
Yeah, you see, there was this young writer, Robert Towne, and I think you can judge his talent from that scene, a wonderful example of movie dialogue where every line takes the plot forward but tells you something about the people at the same time. He had this notion to do three films that really would be the story of Los Angeles in the 20th century, about the way in which water, oil, and transportation took over and changed that city. Now, he was the author of this idea. He was like a novelist, if you will. But when you were an author in the movies, you sell your copyright. You do not own what you have written. And I use this story because I think it's a crucial example. He wrote Chinatown, one of our great movies, I think, and I think many people would share that feeling. There was to be a part two, The Two Jakes, which would be about oil, and he was going to direct it himself. That film broke down. Jack Nicholson, a few years later, took it over. But everybody, I think, agrees it was not of the same quality as number one. It didn't have the author's vision. And number three, which was to have been the story of public transportation and how public transportation really got sucked out of Los Angeles, that has never been made. And I make the suggestion, the proposal, that this trilogy could have been one of the greatest achievements in American film. And it's an example of how authorship, the people who really own the idea, because they do not own the property, cannot control it.
Is that a tale oft repeated in Hollywood?
Well, it is a tale oft repeated, and it's interesting that there was a film last year that gave the lie to it, because Mel Gibson came along and he said, I'm going to make The Passion of the Christ. Many people said this film will not get a distributor, it will not find an audience. Mel Gibson owned that film outright himself. He never let the authorship go. He therefore made exactly the film he wanted to make. I'm not making a judgment on the film. The film ended up a huge success, one of the most successful films of last year, and it was exactly the film he wanted to make. Now, I think all too often the films we see are compromises. They are not the films that the people who had the idea really would have wished to see carried through. They've been changed. They've been changed by marketing forces. And these days, I think that often does damage to the creative impulse.
What role does the actor play in all this? We just heard that incredible film clip with Jack Nicholson. As wonderful as the writing is, as wonderful as the directing was in that film, Faye Dunaway and Jack Nicholson.
You've got to have the actors, and you've got to have those voices. And I mean, Nicholson's voice particularly, I think, is a voice that nearly everyone can hear in their heads. They can conjure it up, and many people try to imitate it. Nicholson and Towne were very, very close friends. And in fact, Nicholson encouraged Towne to go with this script idea. Actors these days are very often the most powerful people in the business. They are like studios almost. If an actor says he will make the film, then the film will get made.
Has it gone too far in that direction, do you think?
Well, I think we have, because I think sometimes the actors appreciate their power and they think, well, maybe I could write this or direct it better than the people hired. And there are too many cases of actors stopping films in their tracks and sort of trying to take them over and shape them to their own image of themselves. Actors, I think, more often than not, should do what writers and directors tell them to do.
Can you give an example of that situation you just described?
Well, I think that what happened with the two Jakes is a very good example. Nicholson and Towne's friendship broke up over it. Nicholson thought he would take the film over himself. He had always wanted to direct. He had occasionally directed. And he thought he understood the Jake Gittes character, and he would do it. Now, I'm a big fan of Nicholson, but I don't think that was one of his great successes.
We're talking about the history of Hollywood. What would you like to know about Hollywood? We've got an expert here, David Thompson. He's the author of The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood. Give us a call at 800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get one call in before our first break. Cheryl in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Cheryl.
Hello. Thank you for this opportunity. And I just wanted to say I, too, really admire Chinatown, although I like Faye Dunaway's performance even better than Jack Nicholson's. And I don't feel that she – I still feel that she doesn't get enough attention and et cetera. But my idea was above everyone, I really – love Cary Grant, and it would be nice to see his life story brought to the screen, but done in a very quality, totally quality way. And the only actor that I could think of, although there might be somebody out there better, perhaps, George Clooney might be able to do a Cary Grant. I was kind of curious to see what anyone might think about that idea.
Dave Thompson, Cary Grant.
Well, I share your enthusiasm. Grant is my all-time favorite actor, and I think that we owe a great deal to him. He helped us see what acting in the movies was and what presence in the movies was.
Yeah.
Now, how you would do him, heaven knows. I think that biopics are so difficult because not only do you have to convince the audience that the person on screen is worthy of comparison with the person we all know, but you have to have a screenplay that tells their story. And Grant's story could be amazing because whereas on screen he was always debonair and relaxed, I think in person he was very insecure.
Mm-hmm.
And that contrast, it could be amazingly intriguing. Clooney is a possibility. Clooney has the ease, I think. The only thing I would say, and I don't just say it because I was English originally, but Cary Grant was English originally.
Yes, and I think of that too, that I would prefer an English actor, actually.
I would look in England, and I tell you, here's a long shot, someone you may not even know, but there's an actor in England named Jeremy Northam. He played Dean Martin a couple of years ago in the Martin and Lewis story on television. He showed a great capacity for impersonation. I think he's a very good actor. I'd love to see him.
All right, we're going to continue this discussion about Hollywood when we return from a short break. You can give us a call at 989-TALK or send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary, filling in for Neil Conan. We are talking about a new book that looks at the colorful and complex world of Hollywood. Our guest today is David Thompson, the author of The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood. You're invited to join the discussion. What do you want to know about Hollywood? Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Dave Thompson, in your opinion, we were talking earlier about the fact that movie making is all about in Hollywood, particularly, is about the sort of synthesis of art and commerce. What films or maybe what personalities best managed to synthesize those two things?
Well, I think there's a whole lot of people who have had it for at least a period. I think Griffith, D.W. Griffith, when he made Birth of a Nation, changed the whole nature of the medium commercially and artistically. I think Chaplin had it. Chaplin is really the first international celebrity because of the movies. I think that Walt Disney had it. I think that you could argue that the people who ran the great studios, like Thalberg and Mayer, and maybe an independent producer like David Selznick. I think when David Selznick backed Gone with the Wind against so much advice when it was threatening to bankrupt him, but just had that hunch that this film was going to do something that no film had done before, I think for that year or two, he had it.
You know, we just happen to have a clip of Gone with the Wind. So before you go any further, let's hear a little bit of one of those famous repartees between Scarlett and Rhett.
Oh, Rhett, I was so distressed when I heard you were in jail. I simply couldn't sleep for thinking. It's not true they're going to hang you.
Would you be sorry?
Oh, Rhett.
Well, don't worry. Yet.
Still works, doesn't it?
Why? Why does it work? Let's analyze that. Why does a film like that? There's a lot about it that's hokey, and you look at it now and you think,
yes.
Oh, my Lord.
And a lot that's racist and
yes,
one thing and
yes.
another.
Yeah.
Well, it's become its own legend, and I think children are brought up on the notion that when they're old enough, they will be sat down to see Gone with the Wind, rather in the way we sit our children down to watch Citizen Kane, that kind of thing. But it's an extraordinarily successful melodramatic romance. And although they didn't get on personally, Gable and Lee have a chemistry on screen. They're just fun. You mm-hmm. know, you could sit there and watch them flirt and fight and talk and kiss. And it could go on even longer than the 3.5 hours. It does go on. It speaks to something that I think is awfully important about American movies when they are good. They show us people we like. Mm-hmm. We might not like them if we met them in reality, but the combination of the real people and the characters is magic. And we want to be there. We want to be those characters. And we take the story home in our head and we dream about it and we daydream about it. We fantasize and we become Rhett and Scarlett. And you know, I agree very much with the earlier caller talking about Faye Dunaway, because the woman in Chinatown is really, in many ways, the most tragic and most intriguing character. And these characters, they pass into the culture. They pass into our bloodstream. And we all know some of Rick's dialogue. We all know, she's my sister, she's my, and so on, you know, mm-hmm, from mm-hmm. Chinatown. These things have become axiomatic. We all have them within us.
We're talking about Hollywood, the history of Hollywood, with David Thompson. Give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. Of course, you can send us an email at totn@npr.org. And we're going to go to Eric, and he's in Fountain Hills, Arizona. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how are you today? David, thank you for being on the show. I'd learned an interesting fact this week, earlier, before I even knew this was coming on, that Hollywood, well, the motion picture industry was attempted in its very infancy to be monopolized on the East Coast. And a lot of creative forces sort of fled that monopolization attempt to California, settling in Hollywood. And I wonder, creatively speaking, if that would have been, that attempt to monopolize would have been successful, what kind of creative, you know, contrast would there be with an East Coast, you know, creative forces versus a West Coast creative forces?
Well, I think that's a fascinating point, and it's absolutely true. There was a thing called the Patents Company that really tried to dominate East Coast filmmaking and control of the various inventions, the cameras and the projectors and so forth that were required for filming. And what happened really was that a number of reckless outlaw individuals just went west to get away from the Patents Company, to be free from it. And ironically, it has an enormous amount to do, I think, with the whole opening up of the West. And what happens is that when the filmmakers get to the West, they discover 300 days of sunshine. even today, the sun is shining, although it's quite cold in California. They discover almost every landscape under the sun within easy reach. It is a paradise for filmmaking. And the whole importance of California to America and the world, I think, has to do with the way the film industry takes root there. And the light and the spaciousness and the optimism, these are all subjects that feed into the American movie. I think if movie making had stayed on the East Coast, this is my opinion, it would have been less fantasy-driven, It would have been more realistic, it would have been a little darker, a little colder, and it would not have been filled with the kind of crazy optimism that to this day the East Coast finds disarming in California, and really quite disturbing in a figure like Arnold Schwarzenegger. And, you know, don't let's forget the obvious thing. Arnold Schwarzenegger is an extraordinary movie creation who has become a figure of real political power. It's a very, very Californian story.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Eric.
My pleasure.
You know, I don't know why. I guess because I don't make films. I really hadn't. It was when you wrote about the and mentioned the effect of light in California and the effect that had on film. I just hadn't even really thought about it before, that the fact that they went west really shaped what American movies are. The fact, the geographic location.
Well, I don't think, for example, if the film industry had remained in New York State and in surrounding areas, I wonder whether we would have had the Western as we know it.
We wouldn't have had all those great natural sets to begin with.
You wouldn't have had those settings. I mean, when Eric von Stroheim makes Greed, which I think is one of the great silent films, he says, we will go to Death Valley. I don't care if it's 120 degrees there. We will go there and we will shoot the climactic scene from Frank Norris's novel McTeague in the real place. And films go to the mountains, they go to the ocean here. And you know, it is still one of the most beautiful places you will find on Earth. It's a quality such as Peter Jackson revealed to the world in the Lord of the Rings films. I don't think anyone had ever known or dreamed that New Zealand was like that. Mm-hmm. What he has done for tourism in New Zealand, God only knows. But the movies did that for California. It was when people started to see California on the screen that they really wanted to get there and be there.
All right, let's take another call now from Adam in San Francisco. Hi, Adam.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I had a question about movie criticism and its history and, well, comparing it to early Hollywood versus now.
Okay, go ahead.
Was that the question?
Will you repeat it?
I think we're losing you a bit.
I had a question about movie criticism.
Yeah. What is the question, or is that the question?
Well, I guess I was just wondering about the you know, I don't have a sense of what criticism, movie criticism was like in the early Hollywood days and how it compares to now.
Well, there was not a great deal of film criticism in those days, and there didn't need to be, because for many decades, people went to the movies out of habit. They often went without knowing what the movie would be. They just wanted to go and sit in the dark and look at the light.
Hmm.
The revolution in film criticism in this country occurs really in the 1960s, strongly influenced by criticism in France, the whole Cahiers du Cinéma group. There comes a generation of film critics, the most famous of which would be Andrew Saris and Pauline Kael. And they became national names, and they were much followed. I think that Pauline Kael was probably the writer many New Yorker readers would turn to first. They made talk about film an important subject at dinner parties, and there were arguments over the value of films, films like Last Tango, such as there had never been before. Now, it seems to me that as the movies have concentrated much more on teenage audiences, and that begins in the 1970s too, criticism is less important now. In part because teenagers don't read reviews, they look at the television ads, they hear about the films on the radio. They're not as impressed by what a critic may say. Critics seem like old fogies to teenagers, and, you know, sometimes they are. I speak as one. And I don't think the general moviegoer today knows the name of too many film critics. Roger Ebert, maybe, who has become a very familiar figure from television, but not many more. And Roger Ebert is someone you listen to more than you read.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. We have an interesting email here from Brooke in Charlotte, North Carolina. Could your guest please speak to a part of the reality of Hollywood history, the casting couch? How big a part of the movie business was that phenomenon throughout its history? And do people see that as a stain on Hollywood's history?
Well, I think you have to recognize that the people who owned the movie business, the people who made the decisions about what got done, discovered very quickly that they had thousands of beautiful young women begging for a job. And that's a situation in which not everyone can resist temptation. And I'm afraid that the need to get in a film on the part of a young actress leads to a lot of exploitation. It goes on today. And has it been a stain on Hollywood? Yes, I think it's part of that legend of wickedness, of corruption, that we all think of in connection with Hollywood, and we all actually rather enjoy scolding Hollywood for. There's a strange way in which the movies have encouraged the adoration of these star figures, and yet that trembles on the brink of disapproval, too. And stars themselves know that as quickly as they rise, they can fall, too. That as a public, we are very fickle lovers. Our affections can go over to someone else. And, I mean, we had a newscast about a public idol who is in a very different situation today, Michael Jackson. And stars and celebrities know that just as they are loved, they are in a strange way hated, too, by the public.
David Thompson is the author of The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about blockbusters, but before we get into that conversation, let's hear a little clip from a blockbuster. This is from Star Wars.
Look at him, he's heading for that small moon.
I think I can get him before he gets there. He's almost in range.
That's no moon. It's a space station.
It's too big to be a space station.
I have a very bad feeling about this.
Turn the ship around.
We were talking earlier about the tension between art and commerce in Hollywood. Are the blockbusters we're seeing now the ultimate triumph of commerce over art, or Or are they sometimes art as well?
No, I think sometimes they're a very intriguing mixture of the two. And, I mean, George Lucas is certainly someone who, I think, for a time, held the whole equation in his head. Star Wars was a hugely successful film, and he was almost the only person who believed it would be at the beginning. And it was a film that gave vast pleasure to millions of people all over the world. I suspect that many of the people who loved the early Star Wars films would share my feeling that the later ones do not have the flair, they don't have the magic. And I think that's interesting because it shows that understanding, having your finger on the pulse, you can lose the pulse too. David Selznick made the most successful film of all time with Gone with the Wind, but a few years later, it was as if he had lost touch with the audience. And success sometimes fills people with such confidence that they no longer really understand the nature of their own business. But what Star Wars introduced, among other things, was special effects. It plays very much to the younger audience. And also, it was a kind of filmmaking entertainment that was inseparable from the merchandising that went with it. And many films now depend not just upon us buying a ticket, but upon us buying toys or clothes or souvenirs, subsidiary things that go with the film.
What are Europeans saying about American films these days?
Well, Europeans, as you may have heard, are not terribly happy with America. We're speaking in general terms, obviously, are not too happy with America as a whole. And one of the reasons is that the American movie in a lot of countries is drowning out native product. It is promoted so lavishly and it is made with so much money that it's very difficult for small French films, small German films, small Hungarian films, say, for those films to hold up to and compete with American films. And I think it's part of the disquiet in many countries of the world to the effect that American culture, which is a somewhat adolescent culture, is taking over the world, and people are not happy about it. And anyone who's traveled much in Europe in the last few years knows what I'm talking about.
David Thompson, we have run out of time. I've enjoyed talking with you. Wish we could talk longer. It's been fun.
Thank you so much.
David Thompson is the author of The Whole Equation, A History of Hollywood. He joined us from member station KALW in San Francisco. When we come back, how some cities are dealing with homeless people sleeping in public places and how some homeless people are fighting back. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.